was telling me that he had come out a big way and was basically rehabilitated. And I used to say that I'm glad he recovered, and he used to say to me very angrily, no one ever recovers. We're recovering. And he was doing very well, and we don't know what happened, but it's very difficult to slip back into it again. And finally it came to a point that I told him one night, Dr. Korsky said to me, either one or two things, you throw him out, or you live with it and pay it off. And let me tell you, drug money is expensive. Take it from me, it's very expensive. And the people that you run into, it's either one or two things, you pay off or you find your son at the bottom of the river. And that's frightening. So he said to me, either one or two things, throw him out of the house or let him go to the bottom of the river, one or two. Very hard thing to do. Very hard thing to do. Until I reached the point one weekend that I just felt that I couldn't handle it, not the financial end of it, which was very draining, very draining, but I couldn't handle the emotional ups and downs with it. So I finally told him, at that particular point, either you get out of the house right now or you go into rehab. Now, there was a rehab facility up near Harrisburg called Talbot's, and one of his friends who was in the AAs, which he went to the meetings, there's nothing like a recovery, there's no one as bad as a smoker who gives up smoking, the belligerent about the fact that you smoke and so forth. Well, the same thing is true with the recovering alcoholic. He was belligerent about anybody who would drink, couldn't stand the thought of anyone drinking and so forth, but yet here he was flipping back and forth. He had made a very close friend, and I can't think of the young man's name. I would give it to you, I'm not trying to hold it, but I can't think of it. And he called me on the phone and said, you know, Vaughn is back on coke again. And I said, well, I said, I don't know that he is, I don't know that he isn't, but I have to tell you there are signs that I think he is. So Lauren came home in the afternoon, it was on a Friday or Saturday, and this young man just decided to pop in. And I told Lauren right then and there, out of the house right now or in the town, make up your mind. One day, everything out. He said, well, give me a day or two to think about it. And I said, no, now, right this minute. And we got into a very heavy confrontation, not physical, confrontation. And Lauren knew me to be a soft touch because I was one who would say, all right, pay it off. And, okay, in a couple days and that's all right. But I made up my mind, Dr. Korsky, that this had to be it. Then we had been to a number of psychiatrists, a number of them. And I just said, that's all there was to it. He said, well, there's someone that I had to pay off, and if I pay this person off, then I'll go. And I said, no, now. And he said, well, I have to get my clothes together. He said, what about tomorrow morning? I said, no, now. And I said, I'm not even going to take you there. Young man, I think it's the end of night. And what he had to do is he had to go into Central Medical Pavilion for detoxification. And once he was in Central Medical Pavilion for detoxification, which was 3 days, then they drove him to Harrisburg. He wasn't allowed out of the hospital. He was incarcerated. And they would take him to Harrisburg. And he called me 3 days later when I'd bring him some cigarettes, and I'd bring him shaving soap and so on and so forth, and a couple of undershirts and underclothing and whatnot. So I was done, and I couldn't even give them to him. I had to give them to the people who were in charge of detoxing. And they went through everything, making sure there was nothing in it. Of course, I was glad for that. And he went to Talbot. We went up to visit him afterwards. He came out of Talbot, and he said to me, he said, I've never felt so good in my life. He got involved with the young lady through the 3 A's, and they warned me, don't become involved with them. He got involved with the young lady through 3 A's by the name of Marge Schneider, I think, another Jewish girl, who worked at the PNB up here. And Lauren was having some problems getting, he owed quite a bit of money, And he wanted to get his debts cleaned off. And knowing that I had sustained him before in all these problems, why he didn't want to come to me to help, but I think he wanted to try to show that he was stable enough to do it himself. And this young lady looked up a lot of, she had the ability of looking up a lot of things on the PNB screen, knowing about me that my son didn't even know. So she said to him, I'm going to give you three checks, and I'm going to sign them. You're going to make them out to you. You take them over to the window, get the money, and we're going to consolidate all your loans and pay them off. And in reality, what she did is she stole three checks, and she kept the money herself. And here was Lauren accused of bank fraud. And they called me from the bank right away. I had an excellent, done all my business up here, an excellent relationship. Went up to the bank, and we had an arrangement with were able to work things out as far as we were concerned. But she was, the branch manager was fired as a result of this because he didn't have a closer check. She was indicted and spent some time, I don't know where she is now, but Lauren was so depressed, this happened, just so terribly depressed, led him to go camp again. Now he had just moved and into an apartment from, above the, like a garage house in the back of the ZOA building. Lovely little apartment, and he was in the apartment, came home one night, was presumably to get some eggs and so forth for the next day, was off for a couple of days to get the things in shape and so forth, and said to me, I'll see you on Saturday. I said, fine, because this was on a Monday or Tuesday evening. And he was taking off the rest of the week so he could get his apartment and everything in shape. And Saturday, when he's a great devoted golfer, I called the club to find out if he was out there, and no. I said, well, I'll call the apartment, we'll take one car out. Called, no answer. He kept calling. Went out to the club, and he wasn't there. I didn't know what happened to him. So this young man up here, Squirrel the Locksmith, Nam Grinberg, who was a locksmith that opened up above near the Green Grocer before that. I knew him, so I called him. He very willingly came down, because we didn't have a key yet. The son knew in the apartment, he hadn't given me a key. And the mom was able to get in the apartment and we found him dead. That was the story of Lord.
That's such a heart-wrenching story.
Oh, it's, you know, you hear so many things. Well, time will heal, and so at least you have another child. all these stories, it doesn't heal. The only time gives you is the ability to deal with it. My wife tells me that I really haven't come to terms with his death yet, and I think she's right, I haven't. And I live every day in a fantasy world like I'm going to see him later in the day. And then I come to the realization he's not there, and the pain that I'm going to tell you is horrible. And the only reason I've continued on in the business here, I thought I would sell it and get out of it, and that's the end of it. But I thought that really being confronted with this 24 hours a day in my mind would be the worst thing for me. So I decided that I would stay on because it would be helpful to me psychologically. It would give me something to think and do, and maybe I could help somebody else, which I've become very active in counseling, so not only young deaths, but any death at all. I feel very rewarded that I have stayed on. I have no intention to retire, no intention to sell the business. I said, and told my wife many times, I said, she knows exactly what my wishes are, whether if my time comes, whether it's tomorrow or whenever it is. And Ruth came back to work also, mainly because psychologically it was good for her. So she's a receptionist in the lobby, and she handles all our yard site programs for us, does all that work. But she's active in that state.
I would be interested to know about your counseling. You mentioned that you had to counsel.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of...
Well, Jewish Field Directors of America established see, 19, I suppose about 25 years ago, a program, while I was president of the Jewish Funeral Directors, known as the Interdisciplinary Educational Conference on Grief and Bereavement, with and through and in cooperation with Yeshiva University of New York. And each year, that conference is held. It's really the largest and most prestigious of all the seminars in that particular field. And after my presidency, I became the conference coordinator for the Jewish Funeral Directors for 13 years following that. Each year, the conference is held on a particular subject. Notable person's death, suicide in the young, when a lifelong partner dies, living with terminal disease patients, and the patient dies, all the various types of death syndromes that you can have. And I became deeply involved in the entire spectrum of grief therapy in all the years attending. As a matter of fact, that's one of the pictures with the most prominent psychiatrist in grief therapy there is Dr. Elizabeth Goodwin Ross. That is she in the center there. And that's Rabbi Falk on the right, and then, of course, on the left. So I became very active in that organization and that seminar, and not only as a participant from the standpoint of the knowledge that I could gain, but also as one of the moderators of different sessions for 13 years. So when people come in here, they don't come in and say, can you help me? What should I do in this area? But there's little things that you see in here as you sit here, and very simply try to steer them in certain directions that you know will be best for them. Without fail, there isn't a parent that sits here, and unfortunately too many parents with young children that I come in contact with that don't have a sense of retirement, hiding, and guilt for the child that's died, regardless of what the child died of. And that's wrong. And very fortunately, my wife and I were, as I said, very upfront with this whole situation, because we felt that if Lauren's death was going to mean anything, and death doesn't mean anything, obviously, that it would have to mean something from the standpoint of helping other youth. And if the story was told and was out, maybe it would be helpful. And so therefore, I make no bones about it. When I have a family here and they say, no, we just want private graveside service, we don't want anything in the paper, we don't want anything. I do everything I can to talk them into a reversal of that. And in many situations, most situations, successful. This type of counseling. We counsel sometimes. People sit here and say, I want everything very private. I can't stand it. I can't stand this. I can't stand it. It's too painful. I want a graveside service. I want to make it easy. And I say that death is not something to make easy. And I tell people, I'm not going to try to make it easy for you. I'm going to make it very hard for you. I want it to be hard. Because you can't recover from an illness unless you admit you're ill. So therefore, the first admission of illness is that you've had a death. Period. And even though I want to make it difficult for you, I make it difficult in as much as I want to have you meet head on what you're going through and let me help it make it easy as you go through that syndrome and through that progress.
I understand that you're active in a lot of other community. Mm-hmm. I can't see. I don't know if we should start that now. How much time do we have? Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. We also kind of skipped around, but it would be interesting to know. You said you went to the Rosh Shul and mm-hmm. it was very reformed. Mm-hmm. Well, when you got married and brought up your children, were you reformed, or did you change any, or how was your
No. Ruth and I had kind of an understanding. She came from, her parents were an Orthodox background, as my maternal grandparents were Orthodox. In those years, however, my mother's years, her youth and young girl, she was one of seven children, five girls. Most of the families, Orthodox families, so to speak, in those years, were from an area of community of lower income and not uneducated families. Not that they, I'm not trying to say they didn't have any sense, but they didn't have a formal education. And a great number of those families sought to have their daughters associate with a more higher plane economic and social strata from the standpoint of education, so they went to the Shoal and they went to Beth Shoal and so forth and so on. So my wife was brought up in Beth Shoal, even though her parents were from an Orthodox background, and my mother was brought up in Rosh Hashanah because her parents sent her for that reform appetite of social contacts and so forth. Ruth and I really never discussed quite, not question openly, but vehemently, what routes we should follow. I just told her that I didn't understand any other type of observant approach other than Reform Judaism, although I'm not opposed to learning anything, of course. Ruth had been through Beth Shoal, and their parents kept a very traditional home, a kosher home, and so forth. However, Ruth said that she had no objections, one way or the other, whatever I wanted to do. Well, at that point in time, just after the war, there was an influx of tremendous number of young servicemen who were on the scene and living in the suburbs and so forth, and with no religious organization of adherence is concerned. So the Central Conference of American Rabbis, Union of Hebrew Congregations, came to the conclusion that they had to establish some congregations out there to attract these young couples to Reform Judaism. And one of the ways they could do that, of course, was make Reform Judaism a little more traditional. Rosh Hashanah was at the point that it was around 2,200 families, or 2,300, I think, at the time. I'm not sure. So there was the movement was that they really couldn't service properly any more families than Rosh Hashanah. And Rosh Hashanah wanted to be a part of trying to establish these congregations, satellite congregations. So Leon Falk, David Glick, Judge Lencher, Benny Lencher, I can go on with these names, all maintained their Rosh Hashanah membership, but they were the nucleus in forming Temple Sinai. And Temple Sinai was an offshoot of Rosh Hashanah for the benefit of attracting these young people and not being able to handle any more Rosh Hashanah. So when I came back, I was one of the founders, charter members and founders of Rosh Hashanah, Temple Sinai. And when we started to have services, it was up at the Emory Methodist Church, which is now where the library is. So we used to have Friday services up there, and the men's club sisterhood and brother, and the religious school was held at the Episcopal Church, Church of the Redeemer. And Ruth and I, at that time, we were going together and weren't formally engaged because I had one strong demand, and that is, before we were married, I had to be in my, I had to have my own business. Not for any reason other than I knew that if I went to work for someone in order to maintain a family, I probably wouldn't be living my own business. So I made up my mind that was one of the agreements. Had to be in business for myself before we were married. So every Friday night I was at dinner with my in-laws, and then we would go to Temple Sinai services at the Emory Methodist Church. And I suppose Ruth liked what she saw and heard, although she never vocally stated it to me, and became active in the sisterhood, became active in the Sinai. So we maintained our religious preference, I suppose, out of accident more than out of any sit-down discussions which way we were going to go. Her parents had no objections to it. My parents wouldn't have had any objection if I had become affiliated with a conservative synagogue. I don't know that I would have understood too much. Probably learned through studying it, but I think I learned more about Judaism and religion and the background and laws and so forth in this business than I would have any more in any synagogue. Because I can relatively equally discuss with most all the rabbis in the city Judaism, the background of Judaism, and the law, as far as this business is concerned, anyhow, they respect me as such.
You've been in business for a long time, and what I wonder is, how has it changed over the years?
Oh, tremendously. Tremendously. One of the things is, and I say this with a certain amount of jest and to make a point, everybody today is a graduate of the Marcus Weldon School of Medicine, or the Perry Mason School of Law. Television has brought people to the forefront of whatever they see and hear has to be factual. My grandfather used to tell me, believe nothing that you hear, only half of what you read and nothing that you hear. And that's largely true of television. Case in point, Dateline with Jane Pauley, NBC. It came apart at the seams as a result of the fixed explosion on the GMC side collision of the trucks. Week before that, they had an expose of the funeral industry, which was, they had no facts at all, they had no credibility. But everyone today is a graduate of television school of whatever. So they know more about what should be done in the business than I know as a licensed funeral director, that any doctor knows as a licensed doctor or physician, that any dentist knows. They know that you go to the drugstore, if you have an ache and pain, you buy Motrin IV and you take it. Why bother with a doctor? And if you've got a sinus, go to the drugstore and get some of Vicks of this or something of that. And everybody's taking everybody else's medicines and they think they know what they're doing. And it's not healthy, it's not good. The same thing is true about this business. Added to the complexity of the very mobile society that we have. People moved here from New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Cleveland, Los Angeles, the large cities, where the funeral home of those years was still the inner city funeral home. And people who lived in the suburban areas, great distances, found a lot of reasons not to move to the funeral homes in the evening. Number one, they were afraid of crime in the inner city. Number two, they had to hire a babysitter. Number three, they had to give up a full evening. Take them in a half an hour to an hour drive to the funeral home, have to stay a half an hour, take them about a half an hour to get back again. So the whole evening was shot with around 3 or 4 hours, plus the expense. So the idea was, well, I'll not go to the funeral. I'm not going to go tonight. We'll go to the services. And then when the services came about, well, I can't. I've got a hairdresser, a dressmaker, a doctor's appointment, or wherever, a card game, or playing golf. So we won't go to the services. We'll go to the shiva afterwards. And so it's all well-intentioned. And with this mobile society and all these reasons with it, they came to Pittsburgh, and here these people found we had evening visitations, and they weren't used to it. They thought it was terrible. And a lot of the rabbis said they didn't agree with the so-called cocktail parties in the evening. It's just another party without cocktails and without hors d'oeuvres and so forth. So they largely swayed to continue the evening visitations. And they were successful in doing so. Now, here is a rather strange dichotomy. I love this idea because I don't have to work in the evening. And on the other hand, I know it's not the best thing for the families. The ability of people to come community-wise and offer their support is very helpful to people in grief therapy. But on the other hand, I can understand the reason they don't want to come. But that's one of the severe changes that's happened. Number two, we found that there's a tremendous, and I use it as a jest, tremendous amount of intermarriage. And I don't mean between Jew and Gentile, or Jew and Christian. I mean a tremendous amount of intermarriage between, I'm an intermarriage. Here I am from a classical Reformed family, and my wife's from a classical, basic Orthodox family. And here we marry. Now, which way are we going to go? There are a lot lot of these marriages, a lot of the husbands say, all right, well, we'll do it your way, and they revert back to a more traditional life. So we find more of a traditional approach in the funeral. All aspects of life are affected by it. We also find that the state of Israel really, to a great degree, gave dignity to being a Jew. A lot of people didn't want to go to a Jewish funeral, so they went to Samson's or Freiburg's. And now they find that because of Israel, they're happy to see the Israel emblems around, and they have no objections to looking for Israel bonds and Jewish National Fund. And it's become very classy. At one time, I can remember Dr. Friel saying, if I had mentioned anything about Israel in my pulpit, they would charge me better to be out of town. But now you find an Israeli flag on the pulpit at Rosh Hashanah, and very active in Israel bonds and so forth, as it should be. Don't misunderstand me, I'm not criticizing. But all these social mores, along with the general type of life we've lived today, has come to the point that a complete change in this business from that aspect. Another thing that's happened is the question really of economics. Economics plays a very big factor in our business. When you have a condition that you have now of a recessionary period, that leads people to say, well, in their mind, if I have a service in the evening or a service at the funeral home and people are going to come, and this is really a subconscious thought, it isn't really a thought of forward, they're going to have to buy a better casket because they won't want to be embarrassed. I mean, this is factual now, they don't want to be embarrassed. So let's have a graveside service. We don't have to worry about how much we're going to spend. There are not going to be that many people there, and we'll get away this way. Now, people don't consciously realize that this is what they're doing, but it has some effect. We also find that the social intellect today has a certain force upon the community. We have a certain number of cremations as a result of that, which we never had before. Fortunately, cremations are on the downward trend, as far as I'm concerned, locally. There are upward trends in other sections of the country, but here they're on the downward trend. I am a funeral director here totally opposed to it. However, I'm here to serve people however they want to serve. If it's cremation, I don't try to talk about it. I don't even bring it up. It's not my point to bring it up. But if they say to me, what do you think, Mr. Hirsch, then I vocally say what I think. We have a very peculiar world today. It came about as a result of many years of informality. Let it all hang out. We don't worry about how we're dressed when we go anymore. I remember the days you get on an airplane and you had to be dressed fit to kill. You didn't go without a tie, and women were dressed perfectly. You get on an airplane today, you're lucky if you don't sit down to someone with shorts and a tank shirt on. I travel in jeans myself. So we have a world of informality. Here's 10 cents, go look at the pictures, don't bother me. The kids watch television. You know, I'm not a prude, but the stuff that's on television is a disgrace. I think to myself, how can parents let children sit and watch this, and at the same time, how can you stop it if you're not there? And the parents are very informal about everything. I was never permitted to sit down for dinner at our home in the winter without a tie, shirt, and coat on. In the summertime, I was permitted not to have a coat on, but a tie and shirt. Today, you're lucky if the kids come to the dinner table in a pair of jockey shorts. And I mean that. So this whole world of informality, for instance, Dr. Freehoff, Rabbi Halperin, Benny Lichter, and Rabbi Rose never came to a funeral if they weren't dressed in stripes and a frock coat. You're lucky today when the rabbis walk in if they're dressed. They have blue shirts, green shirts, red tie. I mean, they're dressed, don't misunderstand. This whole world of informality. And that informality has come down to ours also. Now, how does it come down? Well, when people come here, came in the evening, and they didn't walk in and offer their sympathy right out the door. They felt an obligation to stay for 15, 20 minutes, or half an hour, or whatever. And as people sat around, conversations ensued. We don't sit there with a long face and go through the formal crying that we used to. So you sit there, and you don't sit like this all evening. You turn to your friend and say, by the way, how are your kids doing? Where are they? Or the men say, I don't know, this weekend I think I'll play golf and so forth. And you've been to the ball game lately, and conversations ensue. And they're not loud conversations, but you multiply this by maybe 30 or 40 groups of people, and you have a certain informality, and you have that certain cocktail party. So when they said, we're going to stop the evening visitations, my next statement to one of the rabbis was, well, when are we going to stop the funerals? Because now we have the very same thing before a funeral that we had in the evenings. People sit in the chapel.
I think there's a little more.
People sit in the chapel, and again, they're not straight-faced. They're turning to their friend. Where were you last night? And how are your children? Are you going to be at the club this weekend? And you have that same social problem before services. And there's no one in the world that it feels more affected by than I do. And I don't like it, but nothing you can do about it. And oddly enough, women can battle.